Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Joe Hill. He joins us by telephone from New Hampshire. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Hey, Vic. Thanks for having me on.
Joe has a new novel out. It's called NOS 4A2. And Joe, I got to give you full credit. You know, I usually don't get nightmares from reading books, but your book has been giving me nightmares.
Thanks. If you sound it out, the title is a bit of a puzzle, but if you sound it, it's a vanity license plate. It's the license plate on the bad guy's 1938 Rolls-Royce Wraith. And if you sound it out, it actually spells Nosferatu, which is the German word for vampire.
So can I say that's the title of the book, or should I stick with the license plate
number?
That's
the title. When I talk about the book, I call it Nosferatu. I don't sound it out. There were a lot of debates, you know, within William Morrow, who is my publisher. There was a lot of debates about the title because it is sort of a puzzle. It is this combination of letters and numbers. And when you first glance at it, it isn't immediately clear, I think, to most people what it means. But I sort of thought that that was a feature, not a bug, because it makes you stop and think about it. Your mind wants to do something with that title. Your mind recognizes that it's a puzzle and wants to try to make sense of what it really means. And I think that it's interesting. Whenever you can pose a fun puzzle for the reader, that's something you ought to do.
Okay, so the book is Nosferatu, and the bug looks like it got smashed on the license plate here.
Yeah, there's a lot of red on that license plate, and not all of it is rust.
Okay, now I'm really I'm nervous about spoilers, so I don't want to give anything away, but I do want to talk about this book with you. Let's wander.
We'll do our best to be careful.
Okay, let's wander into the minefield. Can you show me the way?
Yeah, I think so. So Nosferatu is the story of a bad fellow named Charlie Manx, who drives this very old Rolls-Royce Wraith that runs on human souls. Charlie is a kind of vampire. He's been alive for 140 years, and he's kept himself young and healthy by draining something essential from small children. He takes kids for a ride in his Rolls-Royce, and eventually he left them out in a place that doesn't exist in our world called Christmas Land, a kind of nightmarish amusement park. And they're normal when they get into his car, but when the kids get out of his car, they're not the same anymore. They've become kind of grinning, ghoulish, frozen vampires. So Nosferatu is about Charlie Manx and about the one kid who escapes from him. And this kid, Vic McQueen, grows up and becomes a reluctant but loving mother. And Vic finds herself forced to confront him once again when Charlie comes for her son. So that's sort of the one paragraph summary of the book.
Okay. And you have this wonderful artwork. As we open the book at the beginning and at the end, we see these beautiful black and whites. They look like old woodcuts.
Yeah.
And in both of them, we have the old covered bridge. And there's an old covered bridge about a mile from where I'm at right now. And these things are always kind of spooky and haunting. And the covered bridge in your story, it's kind of like a metaphor for the power of the mind or the power of the imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, so Charlie Manx has this vehicle that makes him powerful, that can bend reality. Vic McQueen, the young woman who faces him down over the course of the novel, has a power of her own. When she's a kid, she can get on a Raleigh Tough Burner bicycle and ride to this old spooky covered bridge. And the bridge crosses the distance between lost and found. Vic can go out hunting for something, a lost bracelet or the answer to a question. And whatever she's looking for is always there on the other side of the bridge, even if it's hundreds of miles away. So one day when she's trying to solve a puzzle, when she's looking for the answer to a difficult question, she rides down to this bridge and crosses it and comes out in Iowa and hundreds of miles away. And later, Vic finds a way back to that bridge as an adult when she goes out for rides on her Triumph Bonneville motorcycle. And so the book is concerned, the book is very much concerned with people who are so powerfully creative they can use vehicles to warp reality. And I think that's sort of interesting.
Joe Hill joins us. The book is Nosferatu. That cover bridge, in a way, kind of represents your imagination, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is actually not the first time I've written about covered bridges. My very first story that I was paid for was a story about baseball called Better Than Home and the troubled relationship between an intelligent but emotionally disturbed young man and his father, who was the coach of a failing Major League Baseball team. And the key scene in that short story takes place when a little boy gets lost on gets frightened. The little boy gets frightened in the dark of an old covered bridge. And I grew up in Bangor, Maine, and there was a decaying covered bridge over the Penobscot River that my friends and I used to like to go down to and dare each other to cross. I don't think that my parents would have been very happy to know that I was down there playing on that bridge, which was a sort of resting stop for delinquents and drug addicts. And the bridge itself was, you know, already starting to tilt to one side, and no one had any business being out on it. But as kids, we loved it. As kids do love anything that's spooky and crumbling and away from adults.
Okay, so we've got Charlie Manx, who is evil incarnate, or maybe not, but he needs a helper.
Yeah.
And his helper, I have to say, I think he's my favorite character just because he's so creepy.
So the story, in a lot of ways, is a retelling of Dracula, a reimagining of Dracula, with Charlie Manx as the Count, only instead of drinking blood, Charlie drinks spirits. He drains people of their souls. And just as Dracula had Renfield, Charlie Manx has a Renfield of his own, and that Renfield is Bing Partridge, the gas mask man. And Bing is a cheerful fellow, a man of high spirits and simple pleasures, who did something terrible to his parents when he was a teenager and spent a little time in the bin. In a local mental asylum. And Charlie Manx comes along and offers him a doorway to a new and better life. And Bing comes to somewhat worship Charlie and be ready to die for Charlie, and more importantly, to be ready to kill for Charlie, which he's called upon to do quite frequently.
I have the book here on the table, and I'm getting a slight scent of gingerbread from it.
That's right. Bing Partridge works at a chemical plant where they're bottling gases, and this gives him access to a chemical called sevuflurane, which dentists who are listening to the program will be familiar with. It's a chemical that you can use to gas out a patient to perform surgery. In light doses, it kind of makes your patient into a sort of zombie who can respond to commands but can't really think for themselves or exert their will. And I was actually dosed for that, dosed with some sevuflurane when I had my molars removed, and found it a thoroughly creepy experience, and knew, you know, as soon as I recovered, I knew I had to stick that in a story. Charlie Manx has a relationship with Bing Partridge, a sort of arrangement. They go out on kid hunting expeditions together, and Charlie gets the children. Charlie gets to take the children off with him to Christmas land, but Bing gets to have the mothers. It's a deal that suits both of them and doesn't very much suit either the parents of the kids or the kids themselves. The book is Nosferatu is a much bigger book than my first two novels. It's as big as my first two novels put together, and it crosses a lot of time. It takes place over 25 years, and it has a lot of characters, and it also covers a lot of road. So some of the story is set in Massachusetts, and some of the story is set in New Hampshire, and a key character appears in the small town of Here, Iowa. It's a young librarian named Maggie Lay, and Maggie Lay mentors Vic McQueen, Maggie, like Vic, has a unique power all her own, and she was a fun character to write. She's a sort of a punk rock librarian, and I kind of like that juxtaposition of a sort of alternative rock view of life combined with the sort of scholarly aspects of being a librarian. I thought that made for an interesting character.
And Vic is a very complicated character.
Yeah.
She's got kind of a messed up family life, but no matter how screwed up your family relations might be, they're still family, aren't they?
Yeah. I wrestled with Vic for a long time, and I think for me, the key to making her work was the right name. And, I thought about my favorite radio shows and eventually thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to name her after Vic with the book nook. And that's really what pulled her out. I would say that's really what made that character work. And, everything else was kind of secondary. No, when we meet Vic McQueen, she's 8 years old, and we follow her really over decades. And she does have a troubled childhood with a difficult family life from which she very much wants to escape. And she finds her escape in the covered bridge, the shorter way bridge, and this special power that is unique to her. And I think I think a lot of people who come from troubled family lives long for that mystic escape, that way to punch a hole in reality and, get out of the world of the real and into their private world of thought. And so that's what Vic does. And all those trips across the bridge empower her and expand her horizons, but also cripple her in a way. The more time she does it, the more disassociated she becomes. And later as a teenager and then in her 20s, she has some hard times, problematic relationships. She spends a little time in the mental asylum, and she wrestles with a lot. But deep down, she's basically a good person. She has a big heart and a lot of bravery and a lot of courage, and she wants the best for the man she loves and for her son, Wayne.
I love the sense of enclosure that we get in the car, and also when we're going through the bridge. There's something really claustrophobic and frightening about this.
Yeah, that claustrophobia is very powerful. It's a primal fear, and anytime you can get the reader into a tight space and then switch off the lights on them, you're going to create a certain way to create suspense. And so there's a fair amount of that in the book. And then there's also, this place, Christmas Land, which is this snow-covered amusement park with roller coasters and merry-go-rounds and kids who are in a state of absolute delight all the time. They're everything they do is fun.
Uh-huh.
It's the rides or a visit to the candy store or a good bloody game of scissors for the drifter. Because the kids that Charlie Manx dumps at Christmas Land, they don't have anything left in them except for a sense of fun. They don't have any guilt. They don't have any regrets. They just have sort of this core of childhood innocence combined to pleasure. And in American culture, we have a tendency to sort of blindly adore innocence, to worship innocence. But innocence isn't all it's cracked up to be. Very innocent children will happily take a magnifying glass and start burning ants because they don't know any better.
Mm.
And I thought that was sort of interesting to explore and expand on. But also, we associate Christmas with happiness and good times and peace. And the business of horror fiction and suspense is to create unsettling juxtapositions. Lon Chaney once said that there's nothing funny about a clown at midnight. And that's kind of how I feel about Christmas Land. There's nothing all that delightful about hearing Christmas music in the middle of the summer. It's unsettling. Christmas music at 1 a.m. in July, there's something wrong about that. And I think anytime you can create these sort of disturbing juxtapositions, you have a chance to pull the rug out from under the feet of the reader and disorient them. And that's what I like. I like my, I want to keep my readers off balance.
This whole book is really just a gigantic inscape, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I have this idea. It's the Nosferatu is sort of my grand theory of everything when it comes to my own stories. You know, I have this idea that people live with a foot in two different worlds. There's the real world, a world of gravity and physics, of bad jobs and bad hair and, you know, your adult responsibilities. And that's the world that we think of as the real world. But most of us spend just as much time in our private world of thought, you know, a world where emotions have the force of gravity. And, you know, imagination is the bricks and mortar of that landscape, that world. And there are people like Vic and Charlie and Maggie who can combine the two, who can take what's in their inscape and drag it into the real world. And, you know, I think that's kind of a wonderful, magical idea. And at the same time, I actually think it's pretty typical that this is what creative people do all the time. Keith Richards hears a melody in his inscape, you know, in his private world of thought. Keith Richards hears a melody, and then he creates it on the guitar and brings it into the real world and sticks it into your head. This idea, I think human beings are driven to try to make the real world more like their inner worlds. And certainly that's what writers do and what artists do. And it's also what the heroes and villains do in Nosferatu.
Joe Hill joins us. His book is Nosferatu, and you can meet him. He'll be at Books & Company Sunday, May 5th at 2 o'clock. If you're listening to this on Friday, he'll be there this Sunday. If you're listening on Sunday morning, he'll be there this afternoon at Books & Company in Beaver Creek.
Yeah, everyone's going to want to come see me at Books & Company. We're giving out complimentary passes to Christmasland all day. Place so wonderful when you get there, you'll never want to come home, which is fortunate because once you get to Christmasland, you never do get to come home.
The car is such a character in this book, and so is the motorcycle. Is this motorcycle similar to the one that you have?
I have a Triumph Bonneville. It's a new one. It's not a cool Steve McQueen 1968 Triumph Bonneville. You know, I also have, I don't know if it's a, if, you know, it's a weakness or a good thing, but I have a tendency to create characterization through car ownership. In my first book, my first novel, Heart-Shaped Box, was about a rock star named Judas Coyne, and his black 68 Mustang sort of somehow matched his ferocious personality. In the second book that I wrote, Horns, I wrote about a young man turning into a demon. So naturally, the car that he drove was a gremlin. and you know, and in Nosferatu, you have several characters who are defined by somewhat defined. They're I guess maybe not defined by, but their cars are sort of like their personal signature. It expresses something about who they are. You know, Vic has her Triumph. Vic's lover, Lou Carmody, has his snowplow. And Charlie Manx, of course, has the Wraith.
And you probably have a collection of iconic tools. You probably have a hammer and a wrench, at least.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the other thing is the characters in the stories have different tools and instruments they use, which also seem sort of tied into their worldview. At one point in the story, Charlie Manx dies, which is a big problem for most of us, but only sort of an inconvenience for him. He's only dead. Charlie is only dead for about 24 hours. And when he comes to in the morgue, the first thing he does is pick up a shiny silver autopsy mallet. And he uses his autopsy hammer to batter someone into unconsciousness. And he keeps that mallet with him, that autopsy hammer for the rest of the, you know, for the story that follows. And I thought, you know, I'm a big fan of Cormac McCarthy. I love Cormac McCarthy's novels. And in one of his books, he has a memorable hitman named Anton Chigurh. Chigurh was played by Javier Bardem in the film No Country for Old Men. And Chigurh walks around with a pneumatic cattle gun in one hand, and it's basically a kind of nail gun that you use to punch a hole in the skull of a cow and kill it in the abattoir. And I remember reading No Country for Old Men, and thinking how important it is for a bad guy to have a distinctive weapon, you know, a weapon that really seems like, you know, a third hand, an extension of who they are. And so I you know, I felt like Charlie needed something special, that he couldn't just have an axe or a knife. Charlie needed something that, that spoke to his spirit, or maybe his lack of a spirit. And so I settled on the autopsy mallet.
Joe Hill joins us, his new novel, Nosferatu.
NOS 4A2,
just published by William Morrow. I love the horror in this book, but what really makes it work for me is you have this really wild, clever sense of humor.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. You know, when I was growing up, kids my age had posters on their walls of rock stars or athletes, but I was obsessed with a magazine called Fangoria that was a horror magazine celebrating the work of splatter special effects guys, guys like Tom Savini and Rob Bottin, who did the effects for movies like Friday the 13th and The Thing. And, you know, from a young age, I developed a real strong affinity with the guys who did the gross-out special effects of those horror movies. And I've always thought it's interesting that those special effects guys talk about the work that they do as gags. When the alien bursts through someone's chest, that's a gag. And I think that that's just the right word for it, because there isn't much difference between horror and humor. They're two sides of the same coin. When we see Mo hit Larry with a hammer in The Three Stooges, we shriek with laughter.
Uh-huh.
And if I've done my job well, when you see Charlie Manx hit someone with the autopsy hammer, you just shriek. But in both cases, you're essentially seeing the same moment. And you have a very human instinctual reaction to it, which is either, you know, either hilarity or horror.
So we totally identify with Wayne, because Wayne finds himself laughing at all these really gruesome, morbid things.
Yeah, Vic McQueen's son Wayne winds up going for a ride with Charlie Manx, and they kind of fence with each other across hundreds of miles, and gradually the car is draining Wayne of his spirit and making him more like Charlie. And Wayne begins to find himself responding to the humor in things which actually aren't very funny, like running over animals in the road.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, most of us, I think, you know, if we hit an animal in the road, we recoil in horror. But for Wayne, after a certain amount of time in the car, hitting an animal in the road is like seeing someone pop a balloon, you know, a shock that you would respond to by jumping and then laughing. And I think that's also one hallmark of successful horror is when we see people having wrong and disturbing reactions to events, when the emotional response is somehow off, not quite correct for the moment.
I kept picturing this car in a movie theater on a big screen.
Yeah, well, we can always hope. We'll see.
I kept seeing it.
Yeah, you never know. You know, I mean, I do try to. It's a fairly long book, but it's supposed to move quickly. You know, it's supposed to feel like the pedal is down almost from the first pages. And you know, if it takes you 2 weeks or 3 weeks to read it, I probably didn't do my job very well. You know, it's the kind of thing which you should, you know, fly right through. And I think that part of how you make a book that really accelerates is, you know, you focus on the cinematic elements. You focus on elements which, you know, of kinetic action and, you know, physical drama and tension. And I always look for those moments because I'm just terrified of boring people. you know, I have a dread of people getting 15 pages in and saying, not much happening here. I wonder if I can find a funny video about cats on YouTube. you know, so
well, no worries, Joe. No worries.
Oh, thanks.
I flew through Nosferatu, and it was almost 700 pages, and I was wishing it was twice as long. How long did it take you to write this?
2.5 years. You know, your job, I think, as a writer is not to force the reader to do all the heavy lifting. You're supposed to do the heavy lifting yourself so that they can zoom. I am trying to get a little faster. I am hoping to have another book out late next year or early 2015 at the latest. But I have always been someone who really feels comfortable, you know, really only feels comfortable with a piece of work after it's gone through 5 or 6 or 7 drafts. And by necessity, that means working a little bit slowly. I work slowly so that so that people can read quickly. That's the goal.
And I also would like to say that the artwork really adds another special dimension to the book.
Yeah, the artist is one of my best friends in the whole world, Gabriel Rodriguez, who lives in Chile. And we have been collaborators for 5 or 6 years now. I moonlight as a comic book writer. And for the last 5 years, I've been writing an ongoing comic book series called Lock and Key. And Gabe has been the artist on that from the beginning. And he very much, he draws my inscape. You know, he really, what I see inside my head is what he puts on the paper, on the page. And it was such a delight, such an honor to have him come in and illustrate Nosferatu, which has a number of his pictures in it. You know, in the 19th century, fiction for grown-ups was heavily illustrated. Mm-hmm. Charles Dickens, all those novels were illustrated novels. The reason we know what Sherlock Holmes looks like, we know about the deerstalker cap, and we know that he has a kind of hawkish nose, and we know about the pipe and the whole look of his face, not because of the way Arthur Conan Doyle describes him, but because of the way Sidney Paget drew him for the Strand magazine in the 19th century.
Uh-huh.
And because Doyle doesn't really physically describe Holmes at very much at all over the course of the 60 stories, but he knew he didn't need to because he would be working with an illustrator and Paget would illustrate him for readers. And then in the 20th century, I think this feeling developed that illustration was really for kids, and that if you were a grown-up, you could make the pictures inside your head, and you didn't need an illustrator. And I think that that's too bad, because I think that illustration adds a whole other level to a work of fiction and can be really appealing in its own right, and is just, it's a pleasure to the eye. It's a resting point. It's like when you're going on a hike and you get to a clearing and there's a bench and you have a chance to sit and look at a special view. And that's what I feel like illustrations are in a work of fiction. They're scenic rest stops where your eye can pause for a moment and linger on an image from the story. And I just think it was a total mistake for adult fiction to abandon the pleasures of illustration. And I do think that you can look at J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels, which were heavily illustrated, and they were books meant for the young, but that were beloved by adult readers. And I think you can credit that series for sort of waking up publishing to the idea that illustration is a plus, that illustration is something that ought to be considered, even for adult fiction.
Well, it really works. Joe, we really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for talking to me, Vic. I had a blast. This was great.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.